Blog Talk Radio.
To welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our 16th of August episode of 2014. It's great to have you along with us. Our special guest tonight is Dave Four, also known as Fuzzy, who's the original drummer and current drummer of Bubble Puppy. Now, Mike, I have a big question for you, Dave, right off the bat. This is going to be a tough journalistic question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Is it Bubble Puppy or is it the Bubble Puppy?
You know, I think it was at one time the Bubble Puppy, but we prefer Bubble Puppy now. And never Bubble Puppies.
isn't there a kid's show called Bubble Puppies, or is that something different? I thought that
There's a character called, on Bubble Guppies, there's a character called the Bubble Puppy.
Not to be
so
confused.
If you search for us, you're going to find that too.
You're going to see the Bubble Puppy. Well, that's good because I was thinking when I was doing some research on it, you know, there was and to believe I've had this come up in interviews before, Dave, where there are bands that I have used the and it's not right, and there's bands that I haven't used the and it is the. So it's it's just kind of funny to me how that works, but it's great to have taken the time to be with us tonight.
Hey, nope, my pleasure, John.
Well, let's start at the beginning because this is an amazing story, and I think it's so cool that you guys are playing together. I know it's you and Rod are the original players that are in the current band, I believe, and Rod Prince. And one of the things that I love doing when I interview musicians, and I've really had some great opportunities to do that, is just to be able to go back into this magical time in the 60s. Because I grew up, I was a teenager in the 60s, and when this was going on, when music was happening and there was so much going on, it was truly an incredible time. I don't know if it'll ever happen again. Went into a little bit through about mid-70s where I thought it was there was just some kind of magic going on there, Dave. And I interviewed on a Canadian rock band called Klaatu, I think. And when I had them on, I was talking to them, and one of the guys in that band thought that there was like a renaissance of music at that point, that it will never probably happen again. You were there, you lived it, Bubble Puppy lived it. What do you think was special about the time? I mean, the band started forming, what, in the mid to late 60s?
Yeah, it started about 60, started forming in about 66 or 7. I joined the band in 68. They had only played one gig before I joined the band. But as far as the time goes, I think what jumps to mind is that it was the first time that everything was being done. And it's just so special when it happens for the first time. I mean, there were rock bands playing music that you go, where did this come from? And no one's ever heard. Now, everybody's heard pretty much every genre, and you're borrowing from some genre when you have a new band now. But back then, everyone was doing it for the first time, and we were certainly, people would hear our band and they'd go, where did this music come from? It's like, so everything was just so fresh and new and exciting, and you know, people found out you were in a band, they go, wow, you're in a band, tell me what it's like. Now you tell somebody you're in a band, they go, oh yeah, I am too.
And my cousin's in a band, and yeah.
My cousin's in a band, yeah, so what?
That's a great
back
point.
Back then it was exciting. Yeah. It was crazy. We lived in the country, we had a financial backer, we had a van, we had a big PA, we, you know, traveled all over the country, all over Canada, playing. I was on American Bandstand when I was 17.
Wow.
I think. I was on American Bandstand I quit high school, John, to join the Bull Puppy, and 8 months I was on American Bandstand. So it was pretty freaking exciting for me.
So I would ask you this. What did your parents think about that?
Well, my mom would call me occasionally, and I was living at the band house in Austin with the Bubble Puppy, and she'd call me occasionally and go, are you getting enough to eat? You know, my moms are. And then after she saw me in American Bandstand, and, you know, she realized I was making money and having fun, she really got behind it. She was real proud of me.
Well, that's awesome, because I've interviewed Johnny B. Badenjic. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a drummer with Metroid and the Detroit Wheels. And I think they were 14, Dave, when their managers moved that whole band, Mitch Ryder and the whole band, to New York City. I think the oldest was 15. And and there they are, you know, in New York City. And they said they had no idea what to do. And I just think that, you know, when we started off talking about that, that was such an amazingly exciting time. Now, when you're talking about the music at that point, like, okay, the Beatles come in like 63, 64, turn everything upside down, turn Elvis, Carl Perkins, that whole thing just kind of, you know, went a whole different direction. So let's look at it from your perspective. Now, are you from San Antonio, Texas? What part of Texas are you originally from?
Yeah, I'm a true Texan, John. I was born in San Antonio, grew up in Corpus, and moved to Austin as soon as I could. So,
now, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, because one of the things I found, Dave, through doing interviews, is geography means a lot, and some of the bands are very famous in regional areas, you know, just didn't get out of their regions. And they really should have, for, you know, could be record companies, it could be distribution, it could be a lot of stuff. But what was it like when you were a teenager growing up and all this is going on musically, and you're in San Antonio and you're in Texas? What were the musical influence that you had, Dave, growing up that helped you, you know, like right now, you're still, you know, a professional musician, you're playing. What were some of the early things? I mean, there had to be a lot of different types of music going on at that point. So take us back to that and walk us through that.
Well, I was glued to the radio from 1957 on. I was born in 1950, so after about the age of seven, I just never stopped listening to the radio. So there was all that. But I was lucky enough to, no matter where I lived, there was a great music scene. People don't realize this, but the music scene in Corpus Christi was phenomenal in the early 60s. I mean, there was an all-ages club every Sunday at the Carousel Lounge, and all the local bands would go down there and play from like 12 to 5, and no alcohol was served. And it was just hundreds of people there. Sam Neely, you know, a lot of future stars came out of the Carousel. And then the Carousel would have like Roy Head and Sir Doug and all these question mark and the Mysterians. I saw so many bands, and they started having bands at the Coliseum. They had Paul Revere, the Raiders, the Birds. I mean, I saw everybody in Corpus. So it was nonstop inspiration, and you could play. You could gig in Corpus. So I think Corpus was really a big part of me wanting to be a professional musician.
Now, was it when you were listening to these bands, and what were the influences that stand out, Dave, to you right now, that you, when you heard some of these musicians playing, that were like, wow, you know, what I call head turners, where you just think that is amazing. Can you remember some of the early shows that just like blew your mind?
Well, I can remember exactly where I was, you know, when I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand. I can remember where I was when I heard Fire by Jimi Hendrix. So I can remember where I was when I heard Led Zeppelin. So all those bands, like my favorite, my drummer influences are like, I listened to some jazz, but mostly it was Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix, John Bonham, Led Zeppelin, Cream, Ginger Baker. Those are my big influences. Not so much Keith Moon, but those three guys were just phenomenally original. So, and oddly enough, Bubble Puppy, we lived in the country by ourselves. We had three record albums. We had like Cream, Wheels of Fire. We had Steppenwolf and I think Bread. and that was it. We just came up with, we would start practicing. We'd eat dinner about 11 o'clock at night. Somebody would say, hey, you want to practice? And we practiced till like dawn, like 5 nights a week. So we just came up with music. We just invented it. We did not have any influences at the Bull Puppy House. It was just us.
Did you, that's pretty amazing. Did you record any of that early, those early sessions?
Not, you mean when our rehearsal sessions?
Yeah, and just in the house when you were, yeah. Like,
there was no recorders of any kind, no commercial consumer recorders. It's really sad. But, you know, there was a big, wall and sack reel-to-reel you might have. But, we didn't have any recording equipment of any kind. So none of that was recorded.
So let's go. We're still back there. So you're like, when you first meet the guys, how old were you? Were you like 15, 16?
And how did you Rod Prince and I have been friends since we were 15.
Okay.
We were buddies. We were motorcycle buddies in Corpus. He's my oldest and best friend. He's a great guy, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to be back in a band with him now that we're back together. But, I was just a kid. I always tell this story. When I moved to the when Rod called me to join the band, I moved, you know, I went up to Austin and I went to the band house, and you know, I was 17. I was pretty naive, and when I got to the band house, I walked into this pretty adult situation. So I'm not going to go into detail, but
we can read between the lines.
Yeah, and I was just a little kid. I mean, I just finished the 11th grade, so that was kind of fun. It was scary, but it was fun.
So let's go from there. Like you go in, you meet the guys, you meet Rod, you see, they're at the house, right? They have the house at that time.
Yeah, we always lived together, except for the last 6 months. We always lived together.
Now, I think it's kind of cool to kind of look into this because, you know, I've been in bands and I've interviewed hundreds of bands, and there's always this this synergy between a band. It's like a family, and you're going to have people in it you like to be around, and you're going to have people that you don't like to be around. But some of the great bands, you know, it's like they just keep, you know, they know what they want to do, and they work together, and they just connect somehow. Now, how did you know, Dave, that this was going to happen when you met these guys? And do you remember that first time you sat down at the Kit and started playing with them?
Well, they played one gig before I joined the band, and I was there. They opened their first gig. Bull Puppy's first gig was opening for The Who at the San Antonio Coliseum. That was their first gig.
Isn't that – that's kind of a pretty cool way to start, isn't it? Oh, my God.
Yeah, there was no starting at the bottom for those guys.
Oh, that's amazing. So you heard them that night, and then –
Oh, and they completely blew my mind. I mean, I thought, this is the best band I've ever heard. I mean, I was just completely – I enjoyed them more than The Who, to tell you the truth, because Rod always looked at Rod with his playing and his humor. And so when he called me to join the band, I just jumped at the chance. It took me like 2 seconds to decide to go and play with them. So I drove up to Austin, and I don't even remember really – first time we played together, to tell you the truth.
Well, but just kind of thinking of, yeah, that's what I was going for. I was kind of looking at that point that you knew when you played with them that was it, you know, that these guys had it. And I think that it's always, from my perspective as a bass player, Dave, it's always, you know, the drummer, and I know, you know, they connect with the bass player. There should be, anyway. Was that right off the bat with you, or did you just sync in with the entire band?
Well, you have to realize that I was playing with one of the best bass players in the world at the time. Roy Cox was he was up there with Paul McCartney as far as his abilities on the bass. So I, you know, the second I started playing with him, and you know, Roy and I used to go to the Vulcan Gas Company, which is a pretty club. And we would just, he and I would play the whole set, just bass and drums, working out all our parts.
That's awesome.
That's amazing to think of now. But we were so dedicated. That's why we always lived together, because it made it so easy to practice, to get together, to rehearse. It wouldn't have worked if we hadn't been. And like you said, we were a family. We were very, very close and very tight-knit in the beginning.
So you're in the, you hear them play with The Who, you think these guys are awesome, they call you, you start playing with them. So where does it go from there? I mean, how did you guys start? Did you start playing in the Austin area? And the interesting thing is that a lot of bands back in those days in the 60s started off and they had terrible management, or it just didn't work out, and things didn't, bands that could have really made it. But the bands that actually stayed together, I'm always interested in that. You know, it's like you guys, you said you were like a family. You were together, respected each other. One of the things, if somebody were to ask you, Dave, and I'm sure it probably happens to you, that younger bands will come up and ask you, what does it take? What do you tell them to be a professional musician and to actually get a record out there? And you guys had a top record. What advice do you tell young musicians that are doing this, that are looking to do that today, that you've already done?
Well, I always pretty much say the same thing. I mean, people have asked me that question before, and it's pretty easy, really. If you hang in there and you're talented, you'll get your shot. You will get, you know, now whether or not you can capitalize on it or not, but at some point, if you hang in there and you're good enough, you practice hard enough, someone will hear you and go, hey, this guy's pretty good. And you'll get a chance. I mean, you may not be able to. That was what was funny. Once we got to the top, we got pretty darn close to the top, and that was hard. But staying there is just as hard, if not harder, than getting there. And that's something that's quite a shock, because you never think about that. I mean, you never think about, well, what's it going to be like when we got the number 14 record in the nation? You know, you never think about that. But boy, once you get there, it's tricky. Talking about management, we had the band got along great, at least well enough to function together and write good music. the whole time. But we had terrible management the entire time we were together. Terrible, just terrible. Otherwise, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened if we'd had a real manager, but we never did. And we were, you know, too young and green to really even realize it, you know. We said, we just want to play. You know, that's what people always said. We don't care about the business part of it, but boy, you've got to care about the business part of it.
Well, that's a huge part, and that, I think that's what a lot of people are finding out now. But also, Dave, I'm finding out that, you know, I can't compare the music industry with today with back then. I think it's completely different because there's a lot of DIY stuff. People can do things, home recording, a lot of self-promotion people can do on the internet that you couldn't do in the 60s and 70s. It just was impossible to do, to break out of the, you know, out of your region. But when you guys started playing together, one of the things that when I was reading about the band and, you know, talking to you and talking to Rod about, you guys worked hard and you practiced hard and you took it seriously and you really took your trade seriously. And I think that was one, when I've talked to people about that, and Joe Frank Corello, who is in Hamilton, Joe Frank and Reynolds, I talked to him a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him that question. And he said, work hard at your trade. You know your trade. And, you know, I think it's that way with everything. You know, it's like no matter what you're doing. And I think some people, some bands that I've talked to that, you know, they just want to, like, get on stage and beat stars. But it's not like that. So how much time did you guys spend in rehearsal and practice to get your songs ready for, like, the stage and for the studio?
Well, as I remember it, we practiced pretty much, if we weren't playing, we practiced every night. Till, like I said, till about, you know, 11 till dawn. But a lot, you know, if we played Saturday night or something like that, we probably wouldn't practice Sunday. But I would say we practiced 4 or 5 times a week if we weren't playing. Now, in the very beginning, we weren't really that busy. I mean, we kind of had a regular gig at the Vulcan, which was an amazing place. And we played a few other places, and, you know, we were, you know, it didn't cost anything to live back then, so we, you know, rent was cheap, and we had a financial backer, like I said, for a while. But that all changed when we went to Houston and recorded the record. And then all of a sudden, we were just as busy as we wanted to be. We played all the time, and even then, we practiced as much as we could if we were home.
So, is that where let's talk about that. Let's talk about the first time you signed with the label and the first time you guys played to record your music in a studio. Talk us through that piece.
Well, it was funny because we were living in Austin, the band house, and I forget who it was. I think Roy and maybe Gene or something went to the roadie went to Houston, and somehow they ran into the people at IA. Rod remembers this better than I do. Sorry, Rod. He's probably listening.
Hi, Rod.
Anyway, yeah. Hey, everybody. Hey, Mark. Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Rod. Hey, Greg. But so we played our song. Somebody, I guess Roy played the songs for international artist, and they just completely flipped out over us. So we got this cable, we got a telegram from Roy or Gene or somebody from Houston. They never even came back. They said, got record deal, pack up van, move to Houston. that's what it said. I don't think they even came back. I think we just packed up the stuff and went to Houston.
Now, that had to be amazing. So, and that had to be such a rush and such a great feeling to know that. So you leave your place, you go there, and then what happens?
Well, what's funny is, you know, your kid, it didn't even seem like a big deal. Oh, okay. Pack up the van, move to Houston. Okay. Sure, no problem.
No, that's
why
funny.
Not?
Yeah, that's amazing. I've talked to musicians before. I think of the guy here in a second, with Krabby Appleton, Michael Fennelly, and how he told me how he was living in New Jersey, and he graduated from school, and he said he was going to be a rock star, and he told his family, I'll see you later, I'm leaving, and he packed up his stuff, Dave, and hitchhiked across the country to Los Angeles. And he said it wasn't like a big deal.
No, not at all. Well, this high school join a rock band, no problem.
Be on American Bandstand, yeah. So once you guys signed with International Artists, and then at that point, then you guys, was it, okay, we're going to go into the studio. They had a studio. How did that work out? How was that first studio experience?
The studio itself was great. They had, it's called Gold Star Studios, and there's a book on called The Hit Shack. Gold Star is the studio we recorded at is the longest continually operating recording studio in Texas. Destiny's Child recorded there, Bull Puppy, 13-4 Elevators. I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, Johnny Winters, Lightning Hopkins. A lot of people came out of that studio. What was the question?
Well, that's what I wanted to know, what it was like. I mean, you're 17 years old. You go into the studio. So I was just wondering what that studio experience was like. And then, you know, like hearing your music when they were working through it and you started listening to it because you're practicing, you're playing, but now you're hearing it through a professional studio. What was that like?
Well, you know, it was actually great because our producer, Ray Rush, who had worked with Roy Orbison, was a great guy, and when it was just him and we had an older engineer named Hank Poole, and he was one of the funniest guys you ever met in your life. So it was just Ray and Hank and the band for a long time, and very casual. You know, it looked a lot like the control room for Abbey Road. Not the main room, but the control room. Very kind of a homemade looking board, a couple of A7 speakers, but we were totally at home there. I mean, we spent a lot of time there, and I love the studio. I love recording. It was just so much fun. Like Rod, several funny stories, but my favorite is, you know, we worked up Hot Smoke and Sassafras, and when it came to record it, you know, it starts off with feedback, right?
Okay.
So, like I say, our engineer Hank was a really funny guy. And I don't know, maybe he was kidding, but we started the feedback to record Hot Smoke, and he comes running out in the studio going, and he said, "You can't have distortion on a record."
And that's a great story because that's exactly what he would have thought being Roy Orbison, right? I mean, that just can't happen. But that's,
well, that was the engineer that said that, but he was an older engineer. I'm sure he brought up thinking the distortion is a, you know, horrible thing to have on a record. Here we were like making this giant feedback.
Yeah, that's really cool. So then at that point, you guys get the record made. What happens then? I mean, does IA start saying, okay, we're going to put you out there and start touring? And then where was it that you guys remembered, like, touring? Did you go to the East Coast? Talk about that. And I also will know that when you said, Dave, about...
Let me just tell you about IA first.
Okay.
And since they really don't pay us, I can say anything I want to about them. Ray Rush was an angel. He was a genius. He was single-handedly responsible for breaking Hot Smoke. International Artists, as a company, had nothing to do with it. They didn't know how to open a can of beans, basically. But Ray was in the industry, and he got it to all the right people, and it broke almost instantaneously. I mean, seriously, it broke so fast that we didn't even have the album. Our album wasn't finished, and so here we have a hit record on the charts, and our album is not finished. So we just, you know, that's another, the genius of International Artists. They put out that record and it just shot to the top, and so that was crazy.
And how did it feel like with your buddies and everybody back home? I mean, in your family and stuff. I mean, that had to be an awesome feeling. I always think back to that movie, That Thing You Do, where, you know, the band has that moment where they hear their song on the radio. Do you remember, Dave, the first time you heard Hot Smoke on the radio?
Oh yeah. We live in the country. We had moved to Houston, and we had a house out in the country. And we didn't have, you know, we were poor. We didn't have a radio in the house. So Todd had a, this was all AM, right? There was no FM yet. And Todd had a pretty good radio in his car. So we would take shifts sitting in his car because we knew they were going to start playing the radio.
Yeah,
playing
awesome.
The song on the radio, so we took shifts, and all of a sudden we were sitting in the house and we were just honking, like, honk, 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 honk. We all ran after the car, and they were playing our song on the radio. That was phenomenal. That was just completely blowing. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's just got to be one of the best feelings ever because of the hard work and everything, but just hearing it coming through the radio. And you're absolutely right back then. I mean, right now it's so easy. If I want to hear a song, you know, I can listen to any song from anywhere within minutes, seconds.
Right.
Back then, I mean, I'm the same age you are. So back then, it was like, I can remember, Dave, sitting in front of my transistor radio waiting for The Animals to come on, House of the Rising Sun, waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. It's like they're never going to play it. And I thought that it made me appreciate music back then. You know, it was like so cool because you couldn't hear it unless, you know, the radios played it. Now let's talk about that, because I know this, because you got IA, you've got your manager, you've got the hit record, it goes out, people start playing it. Now was it being played in the major markets? Was it big in like in the Texas area? How was that at first for the song?
It got played in Houston, and San Antonio, and then it just took off. Really, there was no time. We're talking about within 2 or 3 weeks, we were on the national charts. It was that fast. And I have a whole story about why it didn't go to number one, and why it didn't break in New York and L.A., but everywhere else.
And you're cutting out a little bit, Dave. Just having a hard time hearing you. Okay. My guest today is Dave Fuhr, of the drummer, or the original drummer and current drummer for Bubble Puppy. You can go on bubblepuppy.com. You can also go on David's website, davidfuhr.com. And let's play a song. Let's play this is Beginnings. This is Bubble Puppy, and we'll be back right after this with our conversation with Dave.
Which
John?
I'm back. Yeah, I can hear you good, Dave. Just welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio tonight. My guest is Dave Four from the band Bubble Puppy. You can go on bubblepuppy.com, see what's going on there. And I know you guys have a gig coming up on August 22nd. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're playing here in Austin at the One to One Bar. Nice little joint.
Talk about how that feels right now, Dave, to play with the band. I mean, it's compare it to, like, you were 17 years old when you were, you know, like you said, and we want to talk about your experience on American Bandstand. I think that would just be awesome to hear. But what's it like now to be back with Rod and to play with the guys, playing the songs, and just describe how it feels to be doing that today?
Well, I'll tell you all about how it feels. But what I like to say is that what the most exciting thing to me is the way we're being received. Like the fans, the people that come see us, it feels like I'm back in the 60s where people really listen to music. I mean, they listen to every note that we play, and they care. Sometimes they applaud guitar solos in the middle of the song. That happens a lot, actually.
Yeah, that's
but
great.
They're just so into it that, you know, that's all you really want as a musician, right? I mean, you want that feeling of being in the band. But even more than that, you want to connect with an audience. And our audience is just the best. I don't know. I can't say any more than that. They're just incredible. They're just right there with us. Somebody's taking a solo or we get some kind of band feel going on stage, the audience, you can just feel them understanding what we're trying to do, which is really nice. You know that as a bass player.
Well, that's because of all the different musicians I've talked to, Dave, I've asked them the question, what's the most rewarding thing that you do as a musician? And that's they always say it's the response you get back from the audience. It's that what you get back from them. That's almost 100% of the time I've heard that.
Yeah, I mean, the band is so great that it's fun. It's fun to play the songs. You know, I'm still not tired of those songs. I've been playing them all my life. They're very challenging, for one thing. So you want me to tell you why we're back together? Would you like to know that?
I would, yeah. That would be great.
We have a paper here, the Austin Chronicle. I'm sure you heard of it, right?
Yep.
It's the people that put on the South by Southwest. So they have their little Hall of Fame in the Austin Chronicle. And Margaret Moser, one of the senior writers, she called us up and said, hey, you guys might want to get back together and practice a little bit because you're up for a Hall of Fame this year.
Wow.
Nominated for that. Yeah, just dropping hints, right? You know, and of course she wouldn't have done that had we not, you know, had a real chance of winning. So she got us on the show. She got us, we played at the Austin Music Awards, which is where they announce all the winners for the Austin Chronicle Music Poll. So, and of course, you know, I don't know if she knew we were going to win or what, but so that's why we got back together, because Margaret Moser called us and said, hey, gave us a heads up about being elected to the Hall of Fame and the Chronicle. So the funny thing was that Todd was in Phoenix. He does some insurance adjusting, but he was out there. Rod has a vineyard in Dublin, so he was up there. I just happened to be in a cover band that played Hot Smoke and Sassafras.
Oh, wow.
Because the two of the guys in the band grew up listening to the Bubble Puppy. They learned to play guitars and bass from the Bubble Puppy. So
That's awesome.
They had played that song in bands before. They played a lot of Bubble Puppy songs and even some Damien songs in bands before. So I said, hey, guys, we're going to be in the Hall of Fame, so if you could kind of help us practice here. And so they started doing that, and David Gehring, the guitar player from that band, he played Todd's part until Todd got back. And then when Todd got back, he talked Rod into doing it. So basically it wouldn't have happened without a couple of guys from Mark Miller and Jimmy Umstadt and David Gehring kind of helped us. They stood in until we all got back together, at least David did. But so then we played the show, and it was just phenomenal. It was so much fun. People went crazy. And we got elected to the Hall of Fame. We won Hall of Fame, and Roy was there. The original bass player was there. So that was great. And we decided it was so much fun. And, you know, we only made $250 for playing the Hall of Fame gig, which was fine because it was an amazing gig. But,
right.
But man, we put a lot of work into that one set. And so we decided to keep playing. You know, why not? We were tight, and people liked us, and it was really, really fun. So we kept playing.
And is there any future plans to record new material?
Well, you know, we've kind of rearranged some of the old songs, and we're just kind of getting our footing as far as coming up with new material. I mean, the guitar players are phenomenal, and where we used to have two-part harmonies, now we have three-part harmonies.
Wow.
It's a guitar army, yeah. And I'm sure you heard how many harmonies we had before.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll be recording some new stuff. If nothing else, we're going to be re-recording the album at some point because, like I say, IA doesn't pay us. So, and all that stuff that you buy in the store is licensed to Charlie Records out of Europe, and they don't pay us. So if you come to a gig, buy the or go to bullpuppy.com and buy albums from us directly. That way we get paid.
Now, I think that's a great point because that's a point that a lot – I think it just takes education, Dave, because some people may never know that. You know, they think, well, you sign with the record label, you're going to get royalties, you're going to get this and that, but that doesn't always happen. So, and then, you know, it's like a lot of bands that I've talked to that have gone back, you know, circled back and start recording again are doing the same thing that you're talking about. They've re-recorded some of their music. They've got their merchandise. They sell their, you know, their merchandise, and that's how they make the money. So,
recovering royalties from the past is almost impossible. I talked to the Kingsmen about Louie Louie,
mm-hmm.
and they mortgaged all their houses and sued the record company, and all they got was future royalties. They didn't even get any
of the past
royalties.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is just re-record it, because then at least you own the physical product then. You still don't have the rights to the music, but at least you can sell the products outright. And eventually we'll come up with some new songs. And that's the only way the band is doing really good. We really are. But the only way we're going to really move forward is to have new product, because that's the industry, the record industry revolves around new product, period. If you don't have new product, you know, it's not going to happen long term, but I think it will happen.
Yeah, I just, you know, wish the best. I think you guys are completely awesome. I haven't heard the new band, and I'd love to. I live in Ohio, so that'd be kind of a long trip down there, but it would be really cool. And I think that one of the things that you hit on, Dave, that makes so much sense to me was that you said now that the audience and the fans just listen to the music. And I love that part, what you said that, because back when I was, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, and mm-hmm. you'd go to a gig and you'd go to a concert, you would just be absorbed. You listening to, you know, everything that's going on musically. It wasn't the show, wasn't the, you know, the lights and all that stuff. That was cool too, but it was the music that moved everybody. And I think that's really awesome that you're feeling that same thing today. That's just got to make you feel really good.
Oh, yeah, it does. And speaking of feeling the music, I don't know if you've ever heard of a nightclub in Houston called Love Street Light Circus.
I have not.
Okay, it's a pretty famous club in Houston. But it used to be there was three sections. Two sections were kind of normal with tables and chairs, but the middle section, they had padded the floor with like foam and naga hide, and they had headboards with pillows. And you lay down to listen to the band. Yeah, she laid on the floor to listen to the band. And so we were like, that was kind of our home away from home. So we basically, and they had a whole balcony with a light show with the clock face, you know, the clock lenses and the oil and water light show with the squiggly amoebas, right?
Yep.
So our first set, and this is what we were kind of famous for, and this is why I think people think we're a psychedelic band, because our first set, we would just jam. We would jam for 45 minutes, maybe play two songs, and then just kind of jam for the rest of the set. And people would lay on the floor, stoned out of their minds, watch the light show, listen to us make up music. And it was all like we were just one big crowd. I mean, it was all just kind of everybody just was just one mind. It was phenomenal.
Yeah,
but that was funny. I wish you could have seen that club.
Yeah, that sounds great. Did you get any pictures?
There are pictures. Some pictures of the club on the – there's one picture of Love Street on the website.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to check that out. So,
and
what
there's
do you
a couple of go-go girls, and people are laying down in the middle.
I don't think that's happening today in the clubs, but I don't know if it is.
No.
Yeah, it's probably not by design anyway, but so why don't we play? I'd like to play one of the Damien songs that I've got here. And for the listeners out there, and Dave, I'd love to have you back again to do another part of this, because I think there's just so much to talk about. So if you're willing to do that, that would be awesome to have you back. We're running down to about a little over 10 minutes left. So when you guys – I know there's a lot between – Hot Smoke, and then when you go to L.A. and you change your name and you hook up with the Steppenwolf's bass player, and all that happens. And I think maybe if we do, we'll start from there in our second part of the interview. But that's basically the same band, right? Bubble Puppy, and then when you recorded the Damien album, that is the same guys, is that correct?
Yeah, it's exact same band. Roy Cox, Potter, Rod Prince, and David Four.
And when you guys, what did you think, and we're going to play this song, but I want to ask you, what did you think about the name change? Was that, did you guys vote on it? Did you think it was a good idea? What was behind that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because we get that asked that a lot. And the thing was it was so weird, because I don't know. We were talking about this earlier before we started the interview, but a type of music came out that was called bubblegum music, correct?
Right.
And if there was anything that we weren't, it was bubblegum music. But because our name was Bubble Puppy, we got associated with bubblegum music. And that was one reason. And I think also we were just trying to make a clean break from international artists. So it kind of made sense to change our name. The bass, like you said, the bass player for Steppenwolf became our manager. We were touring with him, and he was looking to quit the band and start being a manager. So he just said, "Hey, why don't you guys move to L.A., change your name to Damien?" Because, you know, the Steppenwolf and Damien were two books by Herman Hesse. So there was a connection there. So that's why we changed it to Damien. We just packed up. Once again, it was, hey, let's pack up the van and move to L.A., change your name.
That's just amazing.
And that's what we did.
Now, you may already have this, and I would apologize if you do, but has anybody written a book about all this?
You know, there's a little story on the website, and Rod has written the story of his life, but he hasn't released it yet. I have tried to write several times, not the whole story. No.
Well, I think
if I write it, it's not going to be a chronological order of what happened when. It's just going to be there was so many weird moments in the band, so many funny moments, so many bizarre moments in that band that I could just write a chapter on each bizarre thing that happened to us.
I would read it.
And it would be fun.
Well, Dave,
yeah, I think you would. It'd be a lot like this interview.
Yeah, I just can't get enough of the stories. I mean, I've just can't even, it's so awesome to hear what really happened, because people today, you know, they don't really, it's almost in a pioneering stage back then, and things were happening, and it was just so amazing. So many great musicians were out on the road, and it just was a magic time. Let's play Face the Crowd real quick, and then we'll come back and finish up the interview. Is there anything you'd like to say about that song before we play it?
It got some pretty good airplay in Los Angeles while we were out there, so that was fun to hear on the radio.
Well, this is Face the Crowd. This is Demian, and we'll be back to finish up the interview with Dave Forrest, so stick around. We'll be right back. Back with day four of Bubble Puppy. You can go on bubblepuppy.com. Keep up with what's going on with the band. They're going to be playing August the 22nd at the One Club in Austin, Texas. And that would be cool to go there and check that out if you're in the area. If not, just keep up with the band on the site and what's going on. And Dave, it's been awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Hey, yeah, and I'd also like to say that you can really keep up with us on Facebook, too. We have several pages.
That's a really good thing, too, because I think that the multimedia and everything that's going on now has made this connection with the fans and the band and the different musicians, and people love that. You know, it's like being able to say, these guys are accessible, they're real people. You know, I remember you guys from the 60s and 70s, and I think it's awesome that people are able to, you know, keep that kind of communication going between the musicians and the fans.
Yeah, a quick story is that we did a reunion in the 80s, but we couldn't find any of our fans. I mean, you could put a poster up or something like that, but you just couldn't find them. Now on Facebook, we have a lot of the people who used to come see us in the 60s are coming to see us because they're on Facebook and we reached them.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think it's really cool, and being able to just, you know, to meet the fans that you had back then, it's got to be great when they come to the show. It'd be a real thing.
Yeah, it's great for everybody. It's great for us. It's great for them. So
well,
we have a big autograph session at the end of every show, and we sell, you know, albums and CDs and posters and T-shirts and stuff.
Yeah, that's good stuff. We did talk a little bit about how Bubble Puppy albums are very rare, and you know, and I was involved in the record industry there for, or, you know, having vinyl and how, man, how some of these albums can go for such a big piece of money. But I will keep my eye out for Bubble Puppy LPs out there. But Dave, thank you so much. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
No, I'd just like to maybe give a nice shout out to the band members, Rod and Mark and Jimmy and Greg.
And
you guys.
Yeah.
I'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you rehearsal on Sunday.
Well, that'll be great. Well, Dave, thank you so much, and we'll have to set up a part two if you're interested in doing that.
Hey, thank you, and great show, by the way.
Thanks, Dave, and we appreciate everybody listening to John Talk Radio tonight. And stick around. We're going to keep doing this with a great artist lined up. So thanks for everybody listening, and everybody have a great evening, and we'll talk to you later.